Sally laughed. "I think pigeons just adorable," the girl in front said, and Kelly thought, "Looks like I've got a four-nighter at best, and maybe not at all, but good old Florsham better watch out, or he's going to be laying that babe in the lobby." Kelly's suspicion about Eleanor Henderson proved correct, for she was not a four-nighter, or even a six. She loved surfing, and felt secure in Kelly's arms, but that was all. Yet one night, when Kelly borrowed Florsham's convertible, for the Kansas City girl had said flatly, "Why go riding in a Chevy when you can have so much fun in bed?" he drove Eleanor out to Cocoa Head, where they sat in darkness, talking. "In the islands, we call this kind of date watching the midnight submarine races," he explained. "Very witty," she laughed. "How's the biography coming along?" he asked. "I'm quite perplexed," she confessed. "No good, eh?" "I have been sorely tempted to put it aside, Kelly." "Why?" There was a long pause in the darkness, as the late moon climbed out of the sea in the perpetual mystery of the tropics. Along the shore, a coconut palm dipped out to meet it, and the night was heavy, bearing down on the world. Suddenly, Eleanor turned to Kelly and took his hands. "I have been driven mad by the desire to write about you, Kelly," she said. The beach boy was astonished. "Me?" he cried. "What's there to write about me?" She explained in clear, swift sentences, without allowing him to interrupt. "I have been haunted by Hawaii ever since I read my great-great-great-grandfather's secret journal. He stayed here only 7 years, couldn't take any more. And when he got back to Boston, he wrote a completely frank account of his apprehensions. I can see his dear old handwriting still. I shall write as if God were looking over my shoulder, for since he ordained these things, he must understand them." "What did he write?" Kelly inquired. "He said that we Christians had invaded the islands with the proper God, but with an improper set of supporting values. It was his conviction that our God saved the islands, but our ideas killed them, particularly the Hawaiians. And at one point, Kelly, he wrote a prophetic passage about the Hawaiian of the future. I copied it down, and last night I read it again, and he was describing you."
"Gloomy prophecy?" Kelly asked.
"The Hawaiian is destined to diminish year by year, dispossessed, distraught, and confused. That's what the old man wrote. He must have had you in mind, Kelly." Kelly was 23 years old that night, and he realized that in Eleanor Henderson he was mixed up with an entirely different kind of woman. She was 31, he guessed, clean, honest, and very appealing. Her hair was crisply drawn back, and her white chin was both determined and inviting. He put his left hand under it, and slowly brought it up to his. There was enough moonlight for him to see the visitor's eyes, and he was captivated by their calm assurance, so that for some moments the missionary's descendant and the dispossessed Hawaiian studied each other. And finally his hand relaxed, and her chin was released. Whereupon she took his powerful face in her soft white hands and brought it to hers, kissing him and confessing, "I have forgotten old missionaries, Kelly. When I start to write, I see only you. Do you know what I wish to call my new biography? The Dispossessed." They talked for a long time, while other cars came to observe the midnight submarine races and depart. Eleanor asked directly, "Do you call this a life, Kelly, making love to one neurotic divorcee after another?"
"Who told you?"
"I can see Florsham, can't I?"
"Florsham's not me."
"That isn't what Rennie Blackwell told me."
"What did she tell you?" Kelly asked.
"She said it was the one good week of her life."
"Which one was she?" he asked directly.
"I knew you didn't remember. She was the one who told her roommate on the Mauna Loa."
"Of course."
"Look, I don't need to be ashamed of loving a girl like that," Kelly insisted. "Do you suppose Florsham's going to marry the Kansas City girl?" Eleanor asked.
She's doing her damnedest to make him, Kelly laughed. He'll stay with her 4 or 5 months and come home with a Buick.
Why haven't you ever tried it? Eleanor probed.
I don't need the money. I sing a little, play a little slack key, get a little money teaching girls like you. And if I need a convertible, somebody always has one.
Is it a life? Eleanor asked.
Kelly thought a long time, then asked, What makes you think you can write a book?
I can do anything I set my mind on, Eleanor replied.
How come you're divorced?
I'm not.
Your husband dead?
One of the best, Kelly. One of the men God puts his special finger on.
He die in the war?
Covered with medals.
Jack would have liked you, Kelly. You'd have understood each other.
He had a thing about happiness. God, if the world knew what that man knew about being happy.
They sat in silence for some time, and Kelly asked, Why would you call your book The Dispossessed? I got everything I want.
You don't have your islands. The Japanese have them.
You don't have the money. The Chinese have that.
You don't have the land. The fort has that.
And you don't have your gods. My ancestors took care of that.
What do you have?
Kelly laughed nervously and began to say something, but fought back the impulse, for he knew it would lead to peril. Instead, he wagged his finger in Eleanor's face and said, You'd be surprised at what we Hawaiians have.
Truly, you'd be astounded.
All right. Take the 4 pretty girls who do the hula at the lagoon in those fake cellophane skirts. What are their names? Tell me the truth.
Well, the one with the beautiful legs is Gloria Ching.
Chinese?
Plus maybe a little Hawaiian.
The girl with the real big bosom, that's Rachel Fernandez.
And the real beauty there.
I sort of like her, except she's Japanese. That's Helen Fukuda. And the one on the end is Norma Swenson.
Swedish?
Plus maybe a little Hawaiian.
So what we call Hawaiian culture is really a girl from the Philippines wearing a cellophane skirt from Tahiti, playing a ukulele from Portugal, backed up by a loudspeaker guitar from New York, singing a phony ballad from Hollywood.
I'm not a phony Hawaiian, he said carefully. In the library, there's a book about me. More than 100 generations. And when I sing a Hawaiian song, it comes right up from my toes. There's lots you don't know, Eleanor.
Tell me, she persisted.
No, he refused.
Then abruptly, he made the surrender which only a few minutes earlier he had recognized as perilous.
I'll do better. Something I've never done before.
What? She asked.
You'll see. Wear something cool, and I'll pick you up about 3 tomorrow.
Will it be exciting?
Something you'll never forget.
At 3 the next day, he drove a borrowed car up to the lagoon and waited idly in the driveway till she appeared. When she got into the Pontiac, crisp and cool in a white dress, he turned toward the mountains and drove inland from the reef until he came to a high board fence, behind which coconut palms rose in awkward majesty. He continued around the fence until he came to a battered gate, which he opened by nosing the car against it. When he had entered the grounds, he adroitly backed the car into the gate and closed it. Then he raced the engine, spun the tires in the gravel, and brought the car up to a shadowy, palm-protected, weather-stained old wooden house. Built in 3 stories, with gables, wide verandas, fretwork, and stained glass windows.
This is my home, he said simply. No girl's ever been here before. He banged the horn, and at the rickety screen door appeared a marvelous woman, 6 feet 2 inches tall, almost as wide as the door itself, silver-haired and stately, and with a great brown smile that filled her plastic face.
Is that you, Kelolo? She asked in a perfectly modulated voice that contained a touch of New England accent.
Hi, Mom. Prepare for a shock. I'm bringing home a haole wahine.
Lest his mother be aware of the changes he had undergone for this girl, Kelly lapsed into his worst pigeon. His mother left the doorway, walked in stately fashion to the edge of the porch, and extended her hand. "We are truly delighted to welcome you to the swamp." "Mutta Disvahini Eleanor Henderson Smith, Mutta's Vasa." The trim Bostonian and the huge Hawaiian shook hands, each respectful of the other. And the latter said in her soft voice, "I am Malama Kanakoa, and you are the first of Kelolo's Haole friends he has ever brought here. You must be special." "Hey, Mutta, watch out," Kelly warned. "We not in love. This Vahini mo 8 years older than me. She all fixed mo better in Boston."
"But she is special," Malama insisted.
"Special too much. She got a brain, Dakini. Akamai too good."
The trio laughed, and each instinctively felt at ease with the other. Kelly helped by explaining,
"Mutta, dis Vahini she come from long time mission family Quigley. I not speak dis family, but maybe you do."
"Emmanuel Quigley," Malama cried, taking her visitor's two hands.
"He was the best of the missionaries.
Only one who loved the Hawaiians, but he stayed only a short time.
I think he transmuted all his love for Hawaii into his children, and I inherited it," Eleanor said. She saw that she had entered a 19th-century drawing room, complete with chandelier, tiered crystal cases, an organ, a Steinway piano, and a brown mezzotint of Raphael's Ascent of the Virgin in a massive carved frame. The ceiling was enormously high, which made the room unexpectedly cool. But Eleanor was distracted from this fact by an object which hung inside an inverted glass bowl set in a mahogany base.
"Whatever is it?" she cried.
"It's a whale's tooth," Malama explained, "formed into a hook."
"But what's it hung on?" she asked.
"Human hair," Kelly assured her.
Malama interrupted, removing the glass cover and handing her visitor the precious relic.
"My ancestor, the King of Kona, wore this when he fought as Kamehameha's general. Later he wore it when the first mission ship touched at Lahaina. I suppose that every hair in this enormous chain came from the head of someone my family cherished."
She replaced the glass cover.
Then she said, "Kelly, while you show Mrs. Henderson why we call this the swamp, I'll be getting tea. Some of the ladies are coming in."
So Kelly took Eleanor to the rear of the house, through a kitchen that had once prepared 200 dinners for King Kalakaua, and soon they were in a fairyland of trees and flowers bordering a rush-lined swamp whose surface was covered with lilies.
With some irony, Kelly said, dropping his pigeon now that he was again alone with Eleanor, "This was the only land the Haoles didn't take. Now it's worth $2 million. But of course Mom takes care of 100 poor Hawaiians, and she's in hock up to her neck."
To Eleanor, the scene of old decay was poignant, and as red-tufted birds darted through the swamp and perched on the tips of dancing reeds, she saw the complete motif for her biography.
"You really are the dispossessed," she mused, fusing reality with her vision of it.
"No, I think you have it wrong," Kelly protested. "This is the walled-in garden that every Hawaiian knows, for he tends one in his own heart. Here no one intrudes."
"Then you're contemptuous of the Haole girls you sleep with?" she asked.
"Oh, no. Sleeping is fun, Eleanor. That's outside what we're talking about."
"You're right, and I apologize. What I meant was, insofar as they're Haoles, you're contemptuous of them?"
Kelly thought about this for a long time, tossed a pebble at a swaying bird, and said, "I don't believe I would admit that. I'm not as intolerant as the missionaries were."
Emmanuel Quigley said almost the same thing.
"I think I would have liked old Quigley," Kelly admitted.
"He was young when he served here. He became old in Ohio. What a profound man he was."
"Mom's probably ready," Kelly suggested, and he led Eleanor away from the swamp and back into the spacious drawing room, where four gigantic Hawaiian women, gray-haired and gracious, waited.
"This is Mrs. Leon Choi," Malama said softly, "and this is Mrs. Hideo Fukuda."
"Did I see your very pretty daughter dancing at the lagoon?" Eleanor inquired.
"Yes," the huge woman replied, bowing slightly and beaming with pleasure. "Helen loves to dance, as I did when I was younger."
"And this is Mrs. Lihia Mendonca," Malama continued. "Her husband owned the taxi company."
"And this poor little dwarf over here is Mrs. Jesus Rodriguez," Malama laughed. Mrs. Rodriguez was only 5'9" and weighed less than 190 pounds.
"I've told the ladies that Mrs. Henderson is a descendant of dear old Emmanuel Quigley. We hold him very warmly in our hearts, Eleanor."
"I'm surprised that you're not staying with the Hales or the Whipples," Mrs. Mendonca said. "They came over on the same ship with your grandfather, or whatever he was."
"Our families were never close," Eleanor explained.
Each of the five Hawaiian women wanted desperately to explore this admission, but they were too well-bred to do so. And after a while, Malama suggested,
"I'm sure Mrs. Henderson would like to hear some of the old songs."
And soon she had scraped together a couple of ukuleles and two guitars. The stately Hawaiian women preferred standing while they sang, and now along one edge of the room they formed a frieze of giants, and after a few preliminary plunks on their instruments, launched into a series of the most cherished Hawaiian melodies. They seemed like a professional chorus, so easily did their voices blend. Mrs. Choi, with marvelous darting eyes and gamin manner, sang the high parts,
while Mrs. Rodriguez and Mrs. Mendonca boomed massive chords that paved the musical structure.
Each song contained dozens of verses, and as the last chords of one verse lingered in the air, Mrs. Fukuda, in a sing-song falsetto, enunciated the first words of the next. She owned a prodigious memory, and the other ladies did not enjoy singing unless she was along,
for her monotonous setting of the next theme gave them much pleasure.
Dusk came over the swamp, and lamps were lit. The huge women, reminiscent of bygone splendors, stayed on, and Eleanor listened enraptured to their soft conversation, until Kelly interrupted brusquely and said, "I speak one Kanaka play a little slek key tonight. Davahini and me be goin'."
But when the women saw him about to leave, Mrs. Choi began casually humming the first bars of the Hawaiian wedding song, so that Kelly stopped in the shadows by the door. And while light from the chandelier reflected upon him in variegated colors, he started softly into the great flowing passage of love. His voice was in excellent form, and he allowed it to expand to its fullest. When the time came for him to halt, Eleanor wondered which of the five women would pick up the girl's part, and it was Malama. Standing vast, like a monument with silvery hair, she soared into the sweeping lyric portion of the song, and after a while, mother and son combined in the final haunting duet. It was an unusually fortunate rendition, and as the lingering chords died away, Mrs. Choi banged her ukulele several times and cried, "I could sing this way all night." When Kelly and Eleanor were back in the borrowed car, he said, "They will, too."
Eleanor asked, "When your mother came back from Vassar, what did she do?"
"In the hot afternoons, she sang and was good to the Hawaiians and wasted her money. What else?"
Eleanor began sniffling, and after a while said, "I'm bitterly tangled up, Kelly. I can't go back to the hotel."
"I have to sing," he said stubbornly.
"Do you get paid for it?" she asked between sniffles.
"Not tonight, for a friend."
"You lousy, defeated, wonderful people," she said. "Okay, take me back. For a friend, you must do everything."
She slumped against the door, then quickly jumped back beside Kelly.
"Tell me, has this friend, as you call him, ever done anything for you?"
"Well, no."
"So you sing your life away? For nothing?"
"Who's happier?" he countered. "Mom, or the women you know back home?" Early next morning, Eleanor Henderson reported at the library and asked Miss Lucinda Whipple for that book which gives the genealogy of the Kanakoas. At this request, Miss Whipple masked her contempt and studied Kelly's latest sleeping partner, for she had found that over the course of a year, at least half a dozen awestruck Howley women, who, by their ignorance of card catalogues, proved they rarely saw a library, could be counted upon to ask for that book about Kelly Kanakoa. Miss Whipple guessed that one girl probably told the next, for they appeared at regular intervals, and when they reverently returned the book, some gasped, "Gosh, his grandfather was a real king."
Miss Whipple never commented,
but she did observe that with such women, apparently the farthest back they could imagine was grandfather. Beyond that, all was obscurity. But this girl proved to be different. When she completed studying the long tables in the Missionary Museum publication, she asked Miss Whipple, "What authority substantiates this?" Miss Whipple replied, "My great-grandfather Abner Hale transcribed this remarkable document from verbal traditions recited by a kahuna nui on Maui. A great deal of research has been done in both Tahiti and Hawaii, and the account seems to check out at most points." "How many years do you accord each generation?" Mrs. Henderson asked. "I suppose we ought to follow the dictionary and allot each one 30 years. But we feel that in a tropical climate, and judging from what we know to be true, 22 years is a safer estimate. Then, too, you will detect that what the genealogy calls two successive generations is often really one, for it was a case of brother succeeding brother rather than son succeeding father. By the way, you seem to have a substantial knowledge of Hawaii. May I ask what your interest is?" "I am the great-great-great-granddaughter of Emmanuel Quigley," Eleanor explained. "Oh, my goodness," Miss Whipple said in a flurry. "We've never had a Quigley here before." "No," Eleanor said evenly. "As you know, my father had difficulties." Recollection of old and bitter events did not diminish Lucinda Whipple's ardor, for her genealogical interests transcended unpleasantness, and she asked excitedly, "Shall you be in Honolulu on Saturday?" "Yes," Eleanor replied. "Goodness, how wonderful," Miss Whipple said. "It's the yearly anniversary of the missionary's arrival, and I would be truly honored if you would accompany me. Imagine, a Quigley." She went on to explain that each spring throughout her life she had attended the yearly meeting of the Mission Children's Society, and as the roll was called, she had dutifully and proudly stood up for John Whipple, Abner Hale, and Abraham Hewlett, each of whom had figured in her ancestry, as well as for